The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and thieves come suddenly and without warning. At least the one who burgled us last week did. He certainly didn't book an appointment. Or, I came down in the morning, I just found the things gone. And if he did send an email or a text, well, he'd nicked my laptop and mobile long before I could receive them. He'd opened drawers and cupboards everywhere, but didn't take much, fortunately. I had to confess that most of the mess was mine, which you sound rather sheepish saying that to the policewoman as she wanders around. But it was enough to sympathize with this verse. The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and the heavens will disappear with a roar, the elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. Since everything will be destroyed in this way. As I listed what was missing, I read this and reminded myself that I couldn't have taken them with me anyway, not into eternity, which, of course, is where we left off last week. If you've been patiently following us in this series, we've been looking at the gospel story and seeing how it applies to the world of work. And we began by seeing why work matters. That God made us for work. And it was very good. Work, long before the word got reduced to mere paid employment, work was part of the life human beings were made for. Explains why it's so significant to us. Why too long without something useful to do leaves us feeling less than human. But of course that's only a fraction of the story. We went on to see not just why work matters, but why work sucks. Human rebellion. Playing God, deciding right and wrong for ourselves, has distorted all relationships, our relationship with God, our relationship with one another, even with the ground itself, so that the land was cursed to frustrate us just as we frustrate God. The world that was very good now declares something's wrong at every turn. Now, we may have moved from an agrarian to an industrial economy, but the same frustrations have come with us, and attitudes to work and each other, a world which maintains its unpredictably stubborn independence, all help explain why work sucks. And then last week we looked at what God's done. We moved from creation and rebellion to rescue. As we discovered that God's gospel story is a story of grace. Of a love we don't deserve. A love that took Jesus willingly to the cross to bear away our sin. A love that rescues. By grace you have been saved. Through faith. No one is good enough to face God without that grace. No one so bad that God's grace can't reach us and rescue us. Grace saves and also transforms. It isn't just a wiping of the slate clean, it leads to new patterns of living, and these include our working life. We saw that actually we're saved for work. So if we're Christians, we go to work as human beings made in the image of God. Like human beings who've scarred the image of God, but human beings who are being renewed in the image of God. And we got some glimpses of what that might mean in practice, to be saved for work. But it also left the question, isn't the saved more important than the work? Or to put it another way, if eternity is what matters, why bother with time and work? If the average working life, as someone calculated, is 90,000 hours long, why spend them on what only lasts for time? I hope you understand the thrust of the question. Listen to Darrell Cosden as he puts it, and in the fanaticism that might make you wince, listen to the logic of his thinking. He wrote this, "As young Christian teens, my friend and I, like many in our tradition, were obsessed with heaven. Being saved was what really mattered, and seeing others saved was our driving mission. When I was 13, I attended a summer camp where a Bible college professor teaching on Ezekiel explained to us that in all probability, Jesus would return before the end of 1979, a year and a half away. Armed with this belief and timescale, I became a practical theologian. How I should live my life as a result of this belief was self-evident to me. I spent my first year in high school stuffing turn or burn tracts into lockers rather than studying. After all, what difference would study make for an eternity that was just around the corner? I wouldn't make it past my second year in high school anyway, so why concern myself with grades? Since people's final destiny was at stake, and since there was not much time left, it was obvious to me where I should invest my energies. Although you might think such activity foolish, my theological reasoning at that time was really quite sophisticated and consistent. More consistent, it seems to me now, than many who believed like me, yet did not live or work as if they did. I'd grasped the logic that eternity, our final destiny, is what ultimately matters. And with childlike clarity and abandon, I simply lived what I believed. It made theological sense. God and people are eternal. Everything else is temporary. Invest life's energy in eternal things." I mean, there is a compelling logic, isn't it, to the way he was thinking. There is also an obvious fallacy in it all, which, in case you haven't noticed, is that Jesus did not return in 1979. And Darrell was encouraged out of his fanaticism by talk of moderation and balance, but those easily become weasel words if we're not careful, and they can rob us of essential passions or priorities. What we really need, and what Darrell helped discover and then pass on in his book, which is entitled The Heavenly Good of Earthly Work. And if you're interested in a copy, have a word with Charmaine. I'm sure she can get hold of one. What we really need is a broader grasp of salvation. So for this lunchtime, three quick truths to start us off. Here's the first. There is a whole new world ahead. Look again at verse 10. It couldn't make it clearer, could it, that this one will no longer be with us. The day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire. And the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. The future is not the same as this life carrying on and on and on. Eternity involves radical change, and the transition will not just be a blip before life gets back to normal. Fascinating article in the Times at the end of last week about the recession and the first signs of recovery and whether anyone's learnt the hard lessons. And the author, who I'm sure was using selective reporting to make her point, just listed some conversations she'd had back in the city. The city appears determined to forget the last year. "It was a terrible blip," said one Morgan Stanley wife, who's just re-employed her gardener. "The dog walkers are back in business in Hyde Park. I talked to one who is again in charge of 8 Pekingese. We don't talk about my extended holiday," he says. "Property prices in Kensington and Chelsea have risen up to 22% since February. Net-a-Porter sold out of £1,496 Roberto Cavalli thigh boots in hours last week. A Notting Hill football coach explained that he's just been hired exclusively by one family for £100,000 a year to teach their children to dribble. That's football, not eat. Well, 2 Peter could hardly make it clearer to us, could he? Eternity will not be like that. An awful blip, and then as we were before. Look at verse 11. since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? And charmingly respectable materialists is not the answer. There is a whole new world ahead. Secondly, he says, get ready now for then. Look how he goes on. You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire. And notice, it's not heaven. Not what we think of as the future world. Now, he says heavens here. It's the sky, the atmosphere. That'll be destroyed by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. For in keeping with his promise, we're looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. So then, dear friends, since you are looking forward to this, make every effort to be found spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. Now, did you spot? Even in the massive discontinuity Peter describes between this world and the next, the radical changes, the reversal of values that'll be involved, he leaves room for continuity, for things that have carryover into eternity. It's not profits, it's not property, it's not Roberto Cavalli thigh boots, but it is holy, godly, spotless, blameless living. He speaks of that new world. You notice at the end of verse 13, the new heaven and the new earth as the home of righteousness. Yeah, where righteousness will be at home. Where righteous people can be relaxedly at home. That awkwardness at having to draw a line at sharp practice in the office, it'll be gone. Feeling a lemon when you don't join in office party shenanigans will be a thing of the past, because those shenanigans will be a thing of the past. Sticking out like a sore thumb at conversations you can't join in will be no more. I was just speaking to a senior manager this morning, one of the very few Christians in her company. She was just telling me of some of the loneliness she finds at work. The conversations all around her, she put it as people describe their shagging at the weekend and where she fitted, that loneliness is gone. It may feel odd, awkward, embarrassing now, but those goings on are not the Christian's future, so don't make them your present. If it won't do then, it won't do now. Get ready now for then, says Peter. And in all of that, we could add one more thing. That work can be a future investment too. The world of work is not disconnected from an eternal future. Someone said, look, I can understand going to work as a Christian, but taking work to heaven, does that really fit? Well, try this line. What do you make of this? What we do in life echoes in eternity. Well, that could be an encouraging thought for the workplace, couldn't it? It is, I'm afraid, fiction. It just comes from Maximus in the film The Gladiator. But if you look down at what Peter's saying here, he's saying something very similar, isn't he? The eternal future is a real world. Now, please don't reduce it to disembodied spirits floating around in some vague, nebulous existence. No, it's a new heaven and a new earth. As real as this one, but new. With all the faults and the distortions removed. And there's actually every reason for imagining we will work there. We're not just going to be sitting on clouds strumming harps. Many of us will have to retrain. I'm sorry, lawyers, there'll be no jobs for lawyers up there, you know, crime's gone. And it's no good saying you're in the caring profession, we won't need caring for. So doctors, nurses, you'll have to retrain. But I can't sound too smug, they won't need gospel preachers there either, because the gospel will have done its work and I'll have to retrain. No, we may not have the same jobs, but there'll still be work to do. I mean, think of Jesus' parables. You remember the parables of the talents and the minas? The king who goes away for a coronation, Jesus speaking of his death, resurrection, ascension, and leaves servants with some working capital, and eventually he returns. And as the servants give account, he speaks to the one who invested wisely and made much again out of the money, and he says this to them, "Well done, my good servant. Because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. You know, Jesus speaks of management responsibilities in that future. Or what about this? Turn on to the ends of your Bible, will you? Turn to pretty much the very last page, to Revelation chapter 22. Now just have a look where the story ends. And you'll see in the opening verses of Revelation chapter 22 glimpses of where we started, with a garden, a river, the tree of life. Oh yeah, they're echoes, but actually this is a new world. In fact, it's a new city. And then look in at verse 3. See what he says there? There will be no curse. It's lifted. Frustration's gone. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. We'll be working. Glenn used to be part of the All Souls family. He's now a minister elsewhere. And he was looking at the end of the book of Revelation with a group in his church, and they were just very practical, down-to-earth types, and they were looking at the story. You remember how Jesus often speaks of heaven as a great banquet? And they came up with the incredibly practical, down-to-earth question. And they just said, who's going to do the washing up? And it's a great question in the sense that it took the reality of the new heaven and the new earth so seriously. See, of course, you can come up with loads of answers to it. Actually, it isn't a literal banquet, so there won't be any literal washing up. But the danger there is you're not taking the new creation seriously. Or someone else comes up with, well, actually just the cutlery and the crockery, it'll just disappear, so we won't have to do the washing up. And keep everything real. Look at this verse. He said, I think when it comes to the washing up, we'll be the ones doing it. We'll be serving. And actually we'll enjoy it. I mean, most of us have had at least one enjoyable washing up experience in our lives, haven't we? You know, if there's been a gag, it can actually be tremendous fun. Oh, I know there are dozens of other occasions when it's a drag. But this is going to be the good, fun, enjoyable occasion, and we won't break things either. More than that, it would not be out of character at all, would it, to find our older brother Jesus mucking in too and serving. Or here's another little glimpse about the future. Just look back up the page to the end of chapter 21, will you? Verse 24. He's speaking of how the city is lit because God and the Lamb Jesus are there. And he says, the nations will walk by its light and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. Yeah, as if in some way we can't imagine, there will be a continuity between this world and the next. Now don't misunderstand me. The road I build here, the admin I organize now, does not bring in God's kingdom. Only God and his gospel can do that. And I won't walk on that tarmac then. Not in the new creation. And it's God, not social workers or aid workers, who will make everything new in this new world. But just as I'm to develop a character now that fits this new home of righteousness, so it's as if this verse suggests my work now will not be without its traces then. Yet work can be a future investment too. So let me leave you with this thought. If you've ever been to the hotel next door here, St. George's, you'll know there's a restaurant on the top floor, the Heights. If you go on the ground floor, you'll find there are three lifts. And the left-hand one will only take you to the restaurant. It will not stop at any of the floors in between. It goes straight from floor 1 to floor 15. Some people have a spirituality like that lift. Rescue from hell, get you to heaven, nothing else is of any relevance at all. But unless you're the dying thief, remember that thief hanging on the cross next to Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom today with me in paradise, Jesus says, unless you're like the dying thief and you're about to drop off your perch any second now, that lift is a bad model to have for your Christian lives. The other two lifts will give you a much better picture. The ones that stop to all the floors in between. See, God's rescue is not to exclude me from the rest of life. Salvation is to be lived out, not in a vacuum, but in a setting, and it's a setting that includes workplaces as well as much else. Of course, the most vital question I can ask you is, are you in the lift? Do you know God's rescue? Are you part of this story? Is your eternal future heaven, not hell? Is Jesus your Savior and Lord? And if those sort of questions leave you uncomfortable, please, there is a flyer at the back for Christianity Explored. Pick it up and come on that course. It's a great place to ask your questions. But the lift, the story, the rescue God brings, takes me into every corner of life, even the workplace. And the rescue needs to be lived out and spoken out, even there. In fact, it's only because it will take you into the workplace that some colleagues will ever hear the story of Jesus. The story that makes sense of ourselves, our work, our eternal destinies. So as we come to the last page of the story, let me ask you the two vital questions. Are you in the lift? Are you living the rescue? Thanks for listening.